Here at the In the Money Players podcast, we are proud to partner with the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation. Their mission is simple: saving thoroughbred racehorses no longer able to race. And they do more than that, too. They're also helping save people's lives through the TRF Second Chances program. You can read all about it at their website, trfinc.org. And if you want to make a donation, which we encourage all of our listeners to do, please do so through trfinc.org/players, our custom link. We want to show how horse players believe in this cause. That link, again, trfinc.org/players. Hello and welcome to the In the Money Media Network. I'm choosing those words very carefully because while this piece is going to air at the beginning of the regular late week In the Money Players podcast, it's going to do double duty on an iTunes thread introducing a new show. Before we get to that, though, I want to bring in the usual co-host of this late week show. He's also the chief creative officer here at the network. He's the people's champion, Jonathan Kinchin. JK, what's up?
PTF, I'm happy to be with you today, and I've been listening to iTunes, a song on repeat all day today. Reunited, and it feels so good.
You've tipped your hand, JK, as to what's going on here. And what's going on is we're very proud to announce the newest member of the In the Money team. He is a man who's been on these shows many times before. We had the pleasure of working with him for many years. In fact, he's the original host of the show that eventually evolved and became the In the Money Players podcast. We are talking about TV's Matt Bernier. Matt Bernier, welcome to the network.
What's up, boys? Thanks for having me. This is obviously something that Pete and Jonathan, we've spoken about this for quite a while now. This isn't something that has just sort of happened overnight. We've been kicking the tires on it for quite some time, and I've missed sort of the free form or the I don't want to say loose format that is a podcast, but the idea of just being able to riff for a while. And not being at the Racing Form anymore, that void was there. And I've had a number of people ask if I was ever going to get back to it. And it felt like teaming up with you guys was just kind of the right move. So hopefully I'm excited. I hope you guys are excited. And hopefully people out there aren't going to hear this and go, oh, Jesus, not this guy again. But I'm hopeful people will be interested to hear what's still to come.
I know that's happened to both JK and I in various points of my life. I always feel for the jump racing fans who hear me over when I do my appearances as the international correspondent on the Final Furlong podcast, because anytime they hear the American accent, those jump fans know they're going to be getting a flat episode. They're going to be disappointed. I can guarantee you they're saying in their various accents, not this guy again. And JK, well, you know, I mean, I have a feeling you've heard that once or twice in your life.
Oh, we're starting early, are we?
Hey, I dragged myself down with you, so I didn't think it's too bad. But the show is going to be the Matt Bernier Show. Tell the listeners, Matt, what they can expect from this new in quotes podcast.
So it's I think it's going to have a lot of the same elements that the old podcast did. For what it's worth, it's only going to be one a week. We'll cross that bridge down the road, but for right now, it'll be one as opposed to the two that I used to do, and it'll be at the beginning of the week, either Monday or Tuesday. Preferably, it'll probably be up for the most part on Mondays, unless there's some sort of a travel thing. Maybe it goes up on Tuesday, but it'll be kind of the recap show that I used to do, where you go back, we'll take a look at some of the things that happened the weekend prior, how that could potentially affect things going forward, and then also, you know, the three of us have chatted for a while, and I want to include Drew in on this as well. Obviously, the idea of, you know, adding a little bit of sports to it where, and I know some folks when I used to do the previews and I would do the little NFL trifecta, some people enjoyed it. Some people were just kind of indifferent on it. I still think this is not going to be so, put it this way, it's horse racing first and foremost, no question. But I think we want to have a little bit of variety in there as well. And look, if there's any other kind of crazy story that's going on, maybe we'll touch on it as well. But it'll be a lot of let's go back, see what happened the weekend prior, how that can affect things going forward from a racing standpoint, but also from a sporting standpoint. You know, if there's some sort of big news and the Super Bowl was last night, I'm sure we'll touch on that briefly. Or if there's anything else that's just kind of newsworthy, we'll touch on that briefly as well. So, like I said, it should be every Monday for the most part. There will be a YouTube element of it. It'll be very similar to kind of how the old show was. And on the occasion where I'm on the road and maybe the Wi-Fi is not cooperative, maybe there won't be a visual element of it. Maybe it'll just be a slate. But you'll be able to get it in all the podcast spots you typically do, whether it's Apple Podcasts or, well, I mean, the boys know. Wherever you've listened to this show before, the In the Money Players podcast, you're going to be able to find the Matt Bernier show as well. So looking forward to it.
We'll be posting links when the shows come out over at inthemoneypodcast.com. Let's talk Super Bowl for a minute, a little unscheduled. We have to squeeze a lot into a little bit of time here for a couple of different reasons. But I know, JK, you had some thoughts on the big game, which from a wagering point of view, I think, unfortunately, after a promising start, did not go your way.
No, it didn't. I mean, and look, midway in the fourth quarter, it felt like I was already kind of planning where I was going to spend the money, right? It's one of those situations where, you know, you got a little conservative late, I thought. But a lot of times that conservative nature can pay off. So hindsight's 20/20, just like racing, we become way too results oriented. If they played the game again, I think I would take the same side. I would stick with the 49ers. And hope for a couple of lucky bounces in my direction rather than the other way around. So it was a fun game to watch. Happy for Andy Reid. I love seeing people that have success kind of get that validating moment where in their career. And I think Andy Reid got that last night.
It did seem like the biggest moments of the game, whether there was an important no call, there was the crazy 3rd and 15. It did seem like the randomness definitely went against the Niners late on. Matt, what were your thoughts? Were you participating? Were you just observing? What did you have a rooting interest? And what did you think of how it all turned out?
It was a great experience for me. It made my 5-hour flight from Los Angeles go by rather quick. It was painless. The American Airlines flight. I said it all week when I was over at TVG talking about, you know, I didn't have a strong opinion. If I had to, a little bit of a lean would have been Kansas City -1.5. I know some places got it at 1, but it wasn't a strong opinion. I didn't have any skin in the game watching it. You know, I didn't think it was I thought Kansas City was just kind of, I thought they rolled out their, let's call it their B effort. You know, I don't think it was them at their absolute peak, and they were still able to get it done. I think, you know, it helped that you had a little bit more of a conservative sort of play call. And I mean, I know everyone today is showing the two fourth quarters that Kyle Shanahan has had, obviously last night's game, but also the fourth quarter when he was with the Atlanta Falcons and they lost to the Patriots and they were up 28-3. I mean, the fourth quarter drives are just, I hate to say it, they're inept. I mean, they just didn't do anything. But I don't think he deserves all the blame there. I mean, I'm not just saying it because I'm up here in New England and everyone's, you know, today's a little bit of a fun day because we saw Garoppolo just kind of not deliver. But boy, that one throw when he's got, I believe it was Emmanuel Sanders, where he has the secondary beat. And I know it's not like it's a cupcake of a pass where he's thrown out to the flat, but still, you connect with that. The game is probably over if you score that touchdown, if you're San Francisco. And Garoppolo in the fourth quarter, he just didn't deliver. And it is what it is. I mean, it's part of the game, but I thought it was an entertaining game. I didn't think, again, it was the greatest game of all time, but I thought it was all around pretty good. And you do. If you're in San Francisco, you got to feel comfortable knowing that, you know what, you've got a good young coach. You've got a solid young quarterback if they choose to keep him. I can't imagine that they won't because he does have the team has the opt out at this point anyway, where they could cut bait right now. But I'd be stunned if they did that. I still don't know that I'm totally sold on Garoppolo long term. I think he's fine. I don't think he's a superstar like some people, I think, were hopeful that maybe he would be.
Sounds, both of you made very salient points, I think, about the game. None more so than it's so easy with the wisdom of hindsight to be so results-oriented about this stuff when so many of these games come down to a couple of plays and a couple of situations. Let's move on and talk about some horse racing here. Again, it's sort of a truncated edition, but we need to spend a few minutes anyway looking back at these prep races last weekend. And we'll start it off with the Holy Bull, where Tis the Law comes back, earns a 100 buyer speed figure, and looks every bit the Derby contender that many were thinking he was ever since his first start at Saratoga last summer. JK, I know you had some thoughts about the ride you wanted to share. Why don't we start there?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I got two smart people text me immediately after the race, one saying that was the worst ride they've ever seen and one saying that was a phenomenal ride. So I think that's an interesting topic to probably discuss. Look, I understand the psychology that goes into some of the riders' decisions, right? After Manny rode Tis the Law at Churchill in the Jockey Club, he got, you know, just attacked for his ride and got blamed for an awful ride, getting stuck in behind and getting buried and not being able to get out. And so when you're riding the best horse that you currently ride, right? A horse that's the Kentucky Derby favorite and you quote unquote messed up the last ride. When the trainer tells you in the paddock to not get into a speed duel, to take him back, get covered up and let him finish, then like, that's what you do, right? You do exactly what you're told. So I understand that's why he did that. You know, the other side of the coin is if I break on top and I'm three in front with the best horse in the race, I'm not taking back and getting into a vice and getting into trouble and getting in a situation where bad things happen, how we always see 1 to 2 shots get beat. I don't want that, you know, but then, you know, he's got 70-1 Paco on the outside being reckless and, you know, running at him. And I don't think it was a bad ride, but I don't think it was a magnificent, brilliant ride either. I mean, that's coming from someone who's a huge Manny Franco fan.
So many thoughts to unpack off that already, JK. But first, I want to throw it to Matt just to get his general take on specifically the Franco ride, but also just Tis the Law in general.
Yeah, you know, I feel like it's one of those things where it could be a good ride and a bad ride at the same time. I know that sounds like maybe it's a bit of a cop-out, but like Jonathan said, you know, when you break on top and you're already putting two lengths on the field going into the first turn, I don't think in a perfect world, regardless of what the instructions are, I don't know that I want to strangle the horse back and get him into a pocket the way that he did and get into a really tight situation. At the same time, Manny did what he needed to do when the time called for it, where he was able to angle out into the clear. For me, everyone is focused on the ride. To me, it has so much more to do with the horse, what we saw on Saturday. The fact that he did break as alertly as he did, I know he's a little bit sharp off the layoff, but for him to break as alertly as he did, to get into a little bit of a box that he did down the backside early on. But then when Manny asked him to angle out over heels, for a horse to be able to do that, then go up and procure a position that the rider wanted and then come right back to hand and wait for his cue to actually go rounding the far turn and just completely dust the Pat Piancone horse, who ended up running a really nice race. That to me speaks volumes about this horse. A mile and a quarter, who knows at this point, it's way too early to tell. But just from a racehorse standpoint, I loved everything I saw from this horse on Saturday. To me, whether he ends up being a Derby horse or not, I think there's legitimate talent there. I think he's going to be a serious 3-year-old going forward, whatever races and whatever dances he ends up going in.
I'll start with where you began, Matt, and go a little bit deeper in that direction. I think it can be a good ride and a bad ride at the same time, and I think it comes down to what the goal of the connections are. If the goal was to win the Holy Bull, I think it's a terrible ride. And if I bet out on Tis the Law in the race, I would have been nauseous at points. But when you think about the long-term development of Tis the Law, the athlete, and the long-term goal of the Kentucky Derby, I think he's going to get so much more out of that experience for having endured the quote-unquote bad ride. And in that sense, Manny Franco gave him training that Barkley Tag can't give him in the morning. These races at this stage of a 3-year-old's career, they're so important in terms of the overall development of the horse. And I think what you just saw there from Tis the Law might end up moving this horse forward. And Manny Franco may have done him a tremendous favor while at the same time making anybody who wagered upon him completely insane in the moment. I think you can hold both of those thoughts in your head at the same time. And JK, you said it, you described him as the 1-2 shot that I think we thought he was when we previewed the race. How about this? This horse ends up paying 460. Huge overlay, 6-5. Any theories on that?
Here's the thing that I'll say. I think that people were questioning the layoff and he didn't win his last race. And I think maybe they thought this wasn't going to be the race. Maybe he would be a little bit short here. And those, maybe that's why he kind of, you got away with the 6-5. It seemed like free money at this point. But the problem I have with it, and the problem I have with a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking, whether it's, you know, we talked about this off air, whether it's Kyle Shanahan's end of the half decisions with clock management, whether it's, you know, Joel and Javier's rides on Hidden Scroll last year, or it's this Manny Franco thing. Manny did the exact same thing essentially that he did in the Jockey Club, and he was the worst. It was the worst ride of the year. But because this one worked out, it was smart. It reminds me of like that Mike Smith stuff when he made those middle moves on Abel Tasman. It's brilliant because it worked. If it wouldn't have worked, we would have strung him up outside of Saratoga and poked him with, you know, hot iron. You know what I mean? Like, it's ridiculous that you can see the same action and then based on the result, you say if it was a good or a bad action. That part is maddening to me.
There's not nearly as much to say, in my opinion, about the other two prep races. So with that in mind, Matt, if you have a final thought to button up the Holy Bull before we move it on to the Withers, I think that might be appropriate.
No, I thought all in all, you know, maybe Toledo a bit over bet. You know, I thought it was telling that Chad ran him right back there as opposed to an allowance race. But clearly the horse, you know, I mean, got a little bit far back early on, but maybe he's not quite what the connections had hoped he would end up being. And the Biancone horse is not bad. At the Indian, I believe his name is. You know, I think he's a fine little horse. I don't know that I'm going to look at him as a Derby threat, but all in all, I mean, the story going in was Tis the Law, and coming out, it's him as well.
All right, let's move on to the Withers. Max Player gets the job done with an 86 buyer speed figure. Matt, we'll keep it with you for a thought on this one.
Yeah, I mean, look, everyone has kind of talked about a bit of a painful race to watch the stretch run. They crawled home there. And look, it's good that this horse has got the mile and an eighth under his belt, and he looks like a horse that'll just he'll keep running. The question is, how fast is he going to run? How quickly is he going to be able to finish 9 furlongs, 10 furlongs, whatever the case may be? But it was a fine effort. But at the same time, you know, I think it's difficult to look at a race like that and say, well, he was much the best. I don't know that you can say that when you consider the start that Monday Morning QB had, completely spotting the field 2 or 3 lengths when on paper going in. He was a horse that figured prominently early on. And for him to rally the way that he did, but you saw he was still green and goofy with the lead changes and things of that nature. I don't know what I want to do with that race as a whole going forward. But, you know, credit to Linda Rice. She took a shot there with Max Player coming out of that race at Parks. And it paid off here. They've got some points. And I'm sure they'll be looking looking forward to a race, maybe like the Wood Memorial. I'd be surprised if you turn him back to the one-turn mile in the Gotham at this point. Maybe you give him one, and then you just get ready for the Wood at a mile and an eighth. But, yeah, I don't have anything special to really add about this race.
I thought Monday Morning QB showed some real talent. Like you pointed out, that was a very inopportune beginning. I'm still not convinced that the mile and an eighth is even where he's going to be his best. That's a horse that I'm willing to take out of this race and look to potentially bet on where he ends up next. I would assume the Gotham cutback might be suitable for Monday Morning QB. Do you have any thoughts on this one, JK?
I mean, really all I have is no trips. No bad trips and slow races. I just don't think the race was that fast, and so I don't want to get over. I agree on a normal Wednesday, Thursday, an allowance race where I can have the opportunity to bet Monday Morning QB back off of the trip that he had. Great. But who they're going to end up facing next time, there's going to be a faster horse in that race that's coming from either Florida or Tampa or wherever. I'm not crazy about his chances based on the final figure. It just wasn't very fast.
I think shorter might be better anyway. He's just a horse I'm going to keep on the radar, even if things don't go well next time. That's a horse who I figure to bet at some point in the course of the next couple months. You're right. It might not be the Gotham, depending on what all ends up happening there. Let's move out west to the Bob Lewis, where Thousand Words, who you were a believer in on the show, JK, ends up getting the win with a 92 buyer speed figure. Not exactly a move forward. Kind of looked like the best horse just won the race, and he's probably the sixth best in the Baffert barn. Am I being too cynical?
Yeah, I don't think he's that. I don't think he's the sixth best. He's definitely probably the third best. He's probably not the top two. I will say this. He's got the look of a horse that will run all day long.
Grindy.
And he looks like a horse that when he runs in the San Anita Derby or if he ends up, you know, being the Baffert horse that goes on the road to Oaklawn or wherever he shows up, I'm hoping he runs third gets into the Derby and the mile and a quarter is going to hit him square in between the eyes, and he's guaranteed to be in the try in the Derby. So that's what I'm hoping happens with 1,000 words. I just don't think the mile and a 16th is his game. The mile and an eighth is going to help him out a lot. He's a very grindy looking horse. He looked very comfortable, like the 3/8 pole. If you watch that race, he was just grinded away. And I think the mile and a quarter is going to be absolutely perfect for him.
That makes sense to me. Matt, what were your takeaways from the Bob Lewis?
I think overall, I'm looking at the graded stakes races that we saw in California as 2-year-olds and now starting here as 3-year-olds. And the horses that have run in those races, I'm just not super wowed by. Obviously, everyone knows about Nadal. And I know Authentic, you know, he could be anything. But when I see a horse like that who nearly goes over the inner rail, you know, on his own, I need to see a lot more maturation before I go buying into him possibly being a Derby horse. The talent is there. I want to make sure that he's got a mind, you know, in his head rather than just going out there and being a running fool. Nadal is the one that everybody's going to keep an eye on. But as far as this race is concerned, yeah, I didn't think it was bad. I didn't think it was anything great either. I thought it was just sort of nondescript. And I think that's a little bit of a departure from what we've seen over the past handful of years in Southern California. It feels like early on, they really establish a pecking order, and then every other jurisdiction kind of needs to play catch up. And I don't feel like that right now. Of course, we're saying this on February 3rd, or I'm saying it on February 3rd. We've got a long way to go, but I don't know that I would look at California right now and say, oh, well, they, you know, the Derby goes through Southern California right now. I don't feel that way, where I have probably felt that way over the past handful of years. Still early, a lot of things can play out, but as far as this race is concerned, thought it was fine. Inoffensive would be the way that I would put it.
I like it. All right. We have a guest coming up. I am going to let you two get a move on and move on to the next part of the show. But Matt, when can we expect to hear the first Matt Bernier show?
If all goes as planned, it should be up sometime on Monday. And we're going to need to figure out, Pete, you and I will talk about some of the logistical pieces, but I'm going to change a couple of equipment things. I need to empty out my little second bedroom studio because it's loaded with boxes right now. So we got to clean all this stuff out so we're ready to go. But yeah, it should be within the next week or so. And like I said, looking forward to it. And we'll have plenty more to come. And I'm sure there'll be plenty of cross-pollination between my show and the flagship with you guys. So looking forward to everything. Really appreciate the opportunity and excited to get back into it.
Going to be a lot of fun. I look forward to shuffling the deck as well. We're shooting for Monday the 10th. A closing thought from you, JK, before we let you get back to your NHC prep.
Matty, I'm extremely happy to have you on board, man. I'm excited about it. I'm glad to spend this next year brainstorming and coming up with some really good ideas and doing some fun stuff. I'm glad to have you on the team.
Thank you, buddy. Appreciate it.
Okay, with that announcement out of the way, we will bring in our regularly scheduled guest. He is the reigning NHC champion, Scott Cole. Scott, how are you today?
Great, but unless I put together a crazy run, that might be the last time I get to hear those words. So kind of sad.
You'll always be the champ, but you know it's true. You're going to have to give up the reigning part unless you can make history and get this done at Las Vegas over the weekend. What kind of special preparations have you made to try to give yourself a chance at making history this weekend?
So I'm in a little bit of a torn spot, in a different spot than last year, because I just haven't found the time to focus on getting that second entry. And a couple times I've taken a real shot, I've come up a little bit short. I've been really good at getting my horses to run second. And then over the weekend, I took a couple shots, but it's just kind of like either pick and pray or just look at it for an hour and just hope that I, you know, strike gold, but which is never a great strategy. But having the one to lean on is nice. Now my toughest decision is deciding whether I'm going to play in the last chance, first chance. I'm really trying to weigh in my head whether that extra day of handicapping for the one entry I have is better, or is it better to take my shot on Thursday and possibly, you know, run into a problem where I'm not looking at Friday as much. So we'll see how much work I get done before that. Getting to Vegas on Wednesday, I've already started, you know, going through track by track and trying to find the right angles and stats race lens that I want to use. And then I'm hoping will pop up. And it seems like a decent amount of the early entries and fairgrounds, obviously, always puts theirs out really early, but it looked like quite a few of the tracks that are usually at the NHC, from the little experience I have of it, are out already. So
yeah.
I'm looking at them already in my spare time, but, two crazy days of work, being a trader, we have all these, tech earnings that have been going on. I think Google's today. So we just have a lot going on, but, can't wait to get on that plane, and I'm going to get there early as possible and do as much handicapping as I can. And then I have to make a decision about Thursday, but, either way, I'll be more than prepared for the weekend. And I think, you know, as we've mentioned many times, Stats Raceland has really changed the way that you can prepare for something like this.
The ability to prepare efficiently seemed like it was a key for you the first time around. Sounds like Stats Racelens is a part of that, and just having a general analytical mind and the type of preparation you're used to doing and decision making you're used to doing as a trader as well. How do you combine all that stuff to give yourself the best chance when it comes to a tournament like the NHC?
Just try to map out a strategy in your head. I don't really target dollar amounts per se, but, you know, knowing where you're at on the scoreboard at all times and just having a long shot in a lot of races that you like, and also your top pick. If they happen to be the same horse, great. Play it on both entries, play it on or one if you have it, depending on what your situation is. But for me, kind of going through and making sure that you're prepared for both situations on the scoreboard. It doesn't matter as much day one. I kind of focus on just sticking, probably using my top pick all the way through on day one. But as you get into kind of like a moving day situation or farther into the tournament, depending on what the score is, you kind of got to be prepared, or at least in my eyes, you need to be prepared to have the horse you want to play and the horse that you might need to play, especially in the ones that everyone's playing. The optionals, you can kind of wait for a horse that is the right price for you because you have so many options throughout the day. But in the mandatory selections, as it gets closer to the money, you know, I'll play short price horses all day long if I think they're the best. But you also have to be prepared if you're falling down. You got to be prepared with a second choice that might be a little bit of a bigger price and take your shots when you need to take your shots. So I kind of look at it all from a mathematical perspective, and the trading and the horse racing go hand in hand with me because we do, it's usually not me doing it, but it's usually me feeding ideas to really, really smart people that we hire to backtest different things and trading ideas. And in this, you got Stats Raceland to do all that work for you as long as you can come up with the ideas and continue to tweak and work at it. So sometimes it takes a while to get the answer you want. Sometimes it can be the first angle you put in. But as long as you're willing to put in the work, Stats gives you an opportunity to be really prepared with a bunch of different angles for all the tracks you need to play.
You recently got to go up on stage at the Eclipse Awards representing all horse players and accepting your statue for Horse Player of the Year. What was that experience like?
That was one of the more surreal days of probably my entire life because, I mean, you're just looking around a room and now all the people that you talk about all your honor, they're sitting there waiting to see if they won an award. And, you know, I'm backstage and all of a sudden, the maximum security team's coming through and you see the West and everybody there. But then all of a sudden I look up and it's Jason Service passing by and people are just like, welcome. And you're just like, looking, hey man, how's it going? Everybody's just saying congratulations and passing through on this backstage thing. I'm just like, I know you have no idea who I am, but this is so cool for me right now.
That's great. Well, you've done a great job in this year repping us players. And, you know, just as a player watching at home, it was certainly great to see you up there in that role.
Well, I appreciate it. And just could have talked a lot longer about how much you and Jonathan and your show and your content has meant to me over the years. So I really appreciate all you guys do. And I feel like if people just continue to listen to you guys, and especially if they haven't done it before I'd ever even really played in the tournament, I had listened to your guys' show and you guys kind of were the ones who put me on the right track and opened my eyes to an actual tournament, and just continuing to spread the word and hope more people listen to your show because it really changed a lot for me.
Oh, that's so nice of you to say, and we're so happy to play any kind of small part. JK probably will say bigger than a small part. He's probably taking credit for half of the win, but in all seriousness, we're just so happy you chose to include us in those remarks and give us props throughout. And you've been a great guest throughout the year. And regardless of what happens this weekend, we're hoping you continue to share your time coming on here, telling stories and about your life and how you got here. And of course, trying to give out some winners as well. And hopefully not hitting too many more pick sixes where we lose money. But, you know, there might be some of those as well. Go back to the beginning for me. Where did your time in racing begin before any of the tournament play or podcasts or this or that? How did you get into it?
Yeah, I kind of had to talk to this about and kind of think about this in the NTRA, the one that they do yearly that Alicia Hughes just put out. But I remember at a younger age going to a Greyhound track in Kenosha, and that's how I learned how to place a simple bet and kind of look at a racing program, even though it looked like a foreign language to me. It's a little bit different because they do their classes, like class levels with letters, I believe, and there's just a bunch of weird stuff. But it was, you learned about the basic bets and the daily double and like all the, you know, verticals, a few horizontals that they would offer. And so my dad knew all that stuff, and, you know, people always tell the story about how their dad got him into horse racing, all these things. But like he knew how to do that, and we always had fun. But I mean, it was pure gambling the way we were doing it, for sure. But there was always the guys with cigars that would all huddle around and would be real serious and have a million tickets and a million things. So that's kind of when I realized that I was like, those guys seem to know what they're doing a little bit more. There has to be something to this. And you'd try to talk to one or two once in a while, but most of them, I don't know, it wasn't as kind of welcoming as the horse community. But you'd learn things here and there. We'd always watch the Triple Crown as a family, or at least especially the Kentucky Derby. You kind of fall in love there. I'd, you know, maybe place a bet with a buddy that was old enough when I was in high school to like go to the OTB and place a bet here and there, just to have an interest. I think I bet on Big Brown one year or something, but I didn't really start betting seriously until it was like readily available to me. And that was TVG became available right before Palace Nellis won the Belmont, which sometimes they had 2014, but it had to be 2013 because California Chrome was 2014, Faro was 2015. Yeah, so Palace Malice was Orb's year. So 2013, Belmont, TVG becomes legal. I don't think I was seen for about a week. just experimenting with all different kinds of betting. Had some success that weekend. It was probably terrible for me because I thought I knew what I was doing. Had no idea. But then I started, you know, slowly getting more involved with the past performances and trying to figure that out. And software wasn't nearly as advanced back then, but and I was still practicing law at the time. I had my own law firm for a little bit, so being your own boss, it was kind of dangerous. I found myself doing a lot more horse racing than the real estate law and stuff I was doing on slow days sometimes. And that can be good and bad, but it was good for me for learning. But I also was starting to realize that maybe I'm not in the right profession. Then went on to trading, and then you saw a lot more parables. The hours were like, there's a lot of time on, a lot of time off, and technology kind of got you in front of more stuff. So I was a big replay guy. I would watch replays of everything and then try to tell people who to bet. And my family, because they all just wanted to know who to bet in the Derby. I had a little bit of success. But then as data became more available and I started using it more, I started learning more, and eventually figured out that there were tournaments, which I'd played in poker tournaments for so long that it was amazing to me that I didn't know that horse tournaments existed like they do. And like, there was this whole tour out there. I was like, this would have been amazing to know about a while ago. I don't know why I didn't or how I missed it or, you know, where the actual disconnect was, or if there just wasn't as much advertising back then, or especially not in what I was doing, which was a lot of poker and fantasy football and stuff like that. And I think there's so many parables for people like that I hope, not to go off on a tangent, but that we continue to advertise in those arenas, because I think that's where you'll draw more players. But learned that, and then the American Faro run really, really got me going. I loved that horse so much, and I watched the horse as a 2-year-old, came back, watched every prep as a 3-year-old, and was just really invested in that horse. Hit the pick 7 to American Faro that year, but there were two of us. It was a jackpot pool. It was an experimental, like, it was so weird. 10-cent pick 7 that year.
I don't even remember and, that.
Yeah, I think it was 1 year, one and done. And I know that I guess two of us had American Faro. I had the all button in the race before because it was probably an inefficient ticket. and the favorite won over the a long shot by like a head, or else I'm pretty sure I'd have been the only ticket, because I don't think, based on the Alive tickets left, that anybody had the combinations I had left, because I had all by American Pharoah, and I think the other person maybe had like a 2x1 or something. So instead of winning 130,000 with the jackpot, I won maybe 30,000, but that was still a ton of money to me at that time, and probably paid tuition over the next couple of years and lost all of it back. But it just really got me hooked. And listening to your podcast, I think in back when you guys were with DRF, I believe maybe 2015, 2016, somewhere in there. And you guys talk so much about tournaments, and I had these long drives because I was commuting to Chicago once I started trading. So I would spend 3 hours in a car every day. So I would be looking for horse racing stuff to listen to. And I would listen to every show you guys put out, sometimes twice, just to try to listen to every tip that you guys would put out. And then you guys always talked about the tournaments and public handicapper. So I got involved in public handicapper as a free thing that you could do every weekend to kind of keep you involved and keep you in tune with the four races they picked, which I thought was cool. And then also, you guys started talking about the NHC and the tour and different things. So I signed up for horse tourneys, and then started looking at qualifiers. I qualified for the win immediately and was like another probably good and bad thing, because it got me exposed to a tournament, but I was also like, it was one of the first tournaments I ever played in was a qualifier, and I was like lighting it up. I think I scored 190, had 190 some dollars in this tournament. I was like, oh, this is another thing where it came way too easily, and you get stomped back down by this game all the time. So another time where early success probably wasn't the best thing, but it did get me hooked and joined the tour, played the tour fully in 2017. I only online though. And I feel like those are just a little bit, now I'm seeing it more, those are just a lot tougher than I feel like having one great data track where you can bet your opinion and make the most of it. Whereas if you have a great opinion and 25 other people have that great opinion, you're not going anywhere. And I just feel like the online tournaments are good because you can play from home, but they're also can be quite a bit harder. So I did all that, didn't qualify. And then 2018, I finally broke through. I'm trying to think. I won a decent-sized cash tournament.
Where did you get your NHC qualifications for? I can't remember for last year.
So yeah, ironically, those were both online, and they were back-to-back Sundays. It was crazy. So that was 2019. I was laid up for most of that summer. So I was playing mostly online. I had two kidney stone surgeries within a month span.
Not good.
The first one didn't go great, so they had to go in the second one. And anybody's had kidney stones, I've passed about 40. Oof. In my lifetime, and it is a blessing at the time now, though, thinking back, because it kept me inside on the weekends a lot. And I played within a month. I played in every Saturday and Sunday qualifier that they had. And then I remember just missing a seat on a Saturday, getting one on a Sunday. And then the following Sunday, I got my second. I went from never qualifying to having two in 1 week. And it was like, all right, this is what it takes. I'll have a surgery every year.
You don't mean that.
I don't know. If it turns out the way the overall year did, I mean, if it comes with the championship. Yeah,
There you go.
Not so bad.
So we know your price. If anybody needs Scott Coles to have surgery, it costs $800,000. There you go.
Yeah. So I don't know if it was the Vicodin or what it was, but it was something.
LASIKs on for those tournaments. Oh my God. I have a serious question. When it comes back to the time in your life where you made the career change, and this may be a stretch, but was horse racing and the way you enjoyed using your brain while handicapping horse racing, did that have anything to do with your decision to get away from law and towards trading where, well, I would imagine the skill set involved falls much more in line with the fun way you get to use your brain when you're betting horses, or was this just a coincidence?
I don't think it was a complete coincidence. Horse racing, the amount of time that I wanted to spend in horse racing at that time kind of made me realize that I was in the wrong profession because, I had been a lawyer for a few years, and I did about 2 years on my own just because the law firm I had started out with just wasn't doing well enough to keep me on. And there's just a few cases that we got stiffed on. And so I kind of had to go off on my own, or else I was going to have to stay there and be fully commissioned. So if I figured if I was going to do that, then I wanted to go off on my own. And then I just, by the time I built up my client list, high enough, I just wasn't, I'd look at the people that I was going against in different cases and stuff. And I was like, man, these people just look so worn out and I'm just not having that much fun. And not that work's supposed to be fun, but I knew that I had an opportunity to trade. My best friend my whole life had been trying to ask me to come over to trade, or at least give it a shot. And I was getting to the point where I was about almost 30. So it was now or never, because you can't really, you're going against like 20 some year olds. Everybody's coming out of school with all these algorithms and stuff. Now it's just getting a little bit old to be like learning a brand new profession that I really wasn't overly qualified for outside of just having the mind and a law degree. But the horse racing kind of pointed out that I just wasn't in the right spot. And then I liked horse racing so much better than my job. And if I'd have told my parents or anybody else in my life that I was quitting everything just to be a horse player, they probably would have all killed me. So trading was absolutely the right pairing, I think, for me. So horse racing definitely opened my eyes to a lot of things, and I knew that no matter what, I wanted to do a lot of horse racing. So yes, I think it, in a way, it opened my eyes to that career change and kind of made me realize that those went together a lot better than what I was doing.
You talk about the trading world and competing against people with fancy algorithms. I can't help but think about all the computer robotic wagering money in the parimutuel pools. Do you think the fact that, now granted, you have, I would imagine, plenty of technology on your team and what you do for work, but do you think that considering that idea of machine learning being something that's in the markets you're dealing with in your day-to-day in your profession helps you at all as a horse player?
Sure, because just like in trading, I mean, in horse racing, you kind of, your eyes are open to that you can have everything in your favor as much as you might think, but a person can come through the market at any time they want and do anything that they want. And a horse does not have to run just because they've won 100 times in a row. I mean, they could jump over the rail. I mean, they could do anything. So like, it opens your eyes to the fact that there are no sure things in this, and that there are a lot of things that happen very, very late in a time that you couldn't possibly react as a human. Right. So it opens your eyes to all those things impossible, whether it's you see which tracks do it more, but you almost never are going to get the price that you think you're going to get at the gate. All of a sudden the horses are running and the odds just flip out. But it teaches you to rely on more things like the daily double pool and the pick threes, pick fours to kind of determine what a price a horse is going to go off at. And just like in the markets, we have a bunch of machine learning in the works and a bunch of things that are kind of like automating data live and hopefully reacting for us down the road a lot more than we do right now. But you just kind of, you're more aware of how much manipulation, how much action happens in the last like split second where you couldn't possibly react it yourself. So you just, as long as you know those things are going to happen, you're a lot better prepared to handle them.
Do you like the fact in tournaments that there are certainly people using algorithms, Tony Joe famously, and there's other players we could name as well, but it does seem like compared to the pools, certainly you're competing more human to human as opposed to what goes on in the parimutuel pools. Is that an appealing aspect or does it not really matter to you?
I think it's appealing. I think it's appealing. Well, I think just tournament play versus cast is appealing for a number of reasons. It's also appealing because, as you guys have talked about in years past, is just you can have a day ruined by a 50-1 shot in a pick five because there's nothing you can do about it. But if no one has that horse in a tournament or only one or two people have it, life goes on. So I like it for that aspect because you're facing other humans. They have to have it as well. Whereas when you're playing against a cash pool, I mean, if no one has it, then the track just keeps the money. I mean, it's an advantage there, I think. And I do prefer to have a little bit more of a level playing field on that. I can't compete with computer algorithms that are finding and discrepancies in odds right now and dumping in way more money than I have into a pool at the last second if they see an opportunity. And you just, I mean, I couldn't possibly do that right now. So I do think it's a better and more level playing field in tournaments.
I want to talk about your cash betting a little bit more. What type of bets do you do the best with?
I would say, as much as I like the pick five and the pick six, I'm probably best with the pick four, pick three game, just because I can kind of, I just end up using too many horses in pick five and pick six, and I end up getting more inefficient. And it's just, it's longer. As naturally, it's just longer droughts. So I should probably look at that a little bit better than I do. I keep stats to a degree, but I don't keep stats as much as I probably should. I also just don't play cash as much as I did. Sometimes if I'm alive to a huge price in a tournament or whatever, and there's one other horse I'm worried about, sometimes I'll make a bet on that horse. And I'll use it like that, but I would say I'm best at nailing it. If I have a strong opinion on if they're strung together, great. I'll love to play a large daily double, or else a very aggressive pick three is probably what I'm best at. Or occasionally pick four if I have some strong opinions, but I mean, naturally I prefer to play the pick five or pick six because I'm very attracted to large pools. And unfortunately my mindset is just going after huge amounts of money, and it's a bad thing for me. I can't say that I'm as efficient as a cash bettor these days. That's why tournaments are good for me as well, because they don't allow you to play those pools unless you're at Hawthorne.
Right.
So I feel like tournaments are a great thing for me in that, because they actually do force you into playing more doubles, and that's probably what I'm much better at.
You see your weakness as a player in devoting too much time to those bigger pools because of the promise of winning the bigger money. I'm curious to hear a little bit more about what it is you think you don't do well.
I think there's two things. One is, on big days, there's a lot of people, friends and family, that want my opinion on things. So I tend to use too many horses, and in that I don't want to let people down. And I think I get a little bit too scared. So sometimes I let back at the best of me on certain days. And I just think that I probably throw in too many horses in pick five and pick six scenarios where there's a lot of money on the line when my opinions are strong in other places. And it usually ends up that I probably should have played a very strong, even if it's a big carryover that you're playing into in a pick six, my opinion was probably better, and I should have just pounded a daily double or a pick three that I might have hit that day, but I missed one horse in the sequence that I wasn't as strong on. Or you'll overbet it, and you'll have too many horses, and it'll come back, and it'll pay $200, and you put in $600 into the pool. I don't feel like as good at aggressively playing those. And if you are going to aggressively play those, I feel like your win percentage is going to be so low that I should just be more focused on daily doubles and pick threes. I just get so attracted sometimes to the carryovers. I don't know, but tournament play has changed all those things for me. And so, like, when there's a tournament to play, I just feel like that's why it's such a good fit for me, because it kind of takes that temptation out of it. And that's just what I need to focus more on. And I do want to get more. I don't play as much live bank as I would like. And just life gets in the way a lot and work, but when I do get the opportunity to do that, I just prefer that, because it kind of hones in on what I'm better at. And it forces you, if you're going to play multis, I mean, you have to almost every tournament I've ever seen, you can only play daily double. So it's just, it limits your...
Simplifies it.
The temptation.
Simplifies it, I think is exactly right. How would you describe your strengths as a horse player?
I think I was actually talking to Matt Miller about this today on the text, is that I've been really frustrated lately, because when I do actually put the time in, I'm hitting the board a lot, but I'm taking too many horses running second. Sometimes it's just going to happen. But I would say overall, I feel like I've been in every tournament that I've actually like put the time in and put the effort in. I've been in, you know, top, like I took 8th in a tournament the other day, 20th, 25th, like stuff like that. I think the reason stuff multi-day tournaments are my advantage, and there just aren't very many, but when you get the chance in like the NHC, I think my strength is consistently at least getting something out of every day. Whereas in a 3-day total, if people are having one great day, one terrible day, I feel like my strength is that, fortunately so far, now I'm going to say this, I'm going to get zero on the first 2 days of the NHC, but like, I've done a good job of staying in it every day. So by the full body of work adds up to one good tournament, but I have not been great lately at just winning an individual day, but in the NHC or in the Horse Fair World Series that I didn't play this past year, but or other, if you find another multi-day tournament, it adds up by the end. So I would say that I'm consistent, but I haven't been doing a great job at just blowing it out of the water on one given day. But I feel like I've done a good job of always picking most of my horses, always seem to have a chance turning for home. It's just when you are winning place pickalls instead of getting a bunch of winners, you're not gonna win an individual tournament. It's not gonna happen. But if you can stay consistent over multiple days, you know, you're gonna give yourself a chance.
I feel like some of the consistency must come from the fact that you seem to be willing to grab horses at a lower price range than some players who won't play a horse under 6-1, for example. Do you think that's part of the consistency, and how did you develop that style of being able to just take the points in an era where still some of the old school contest players especially just like can't stomach the idea of betting a shorty?
Yeah. I kind of formulated that opinion over the years. You kind of catch up losing a lot of online tournaments, but you can play so many in a weekend. It's kind of like how all the younger poker players caught up when they could just play 8 tables at once on online sites. I was kind of playing as many tournaments as I could do in my head and not like have it explode at once, but like play as many as I could on days I was playing. And you kind of see over time how many you lose or how many good money spots you lose by a few dollars here and there. And you kind of like notice the importance that if you think a horse in a mandatory race, right? If it's optional, yes, you can wait for a better price. But if it's a mandatory race, there are going to be points given and you're either going to get them or you're not. So I could care less what the price is in a mandatory race, because price is going to matter a little bit if you're trying to break a tie. But if you think there is a standout horse, I don't really care what the price is unless I'm down in a tournament. So I'm always willing to take my $6 or my $8 or my $10 in a mandatory race, because that's $6, $8, $10 that could be in a big tournament like the NHC could be 50 spots. And that's 50 people that can't block you in the next race by having the same horse as you. I mean, at the end of a tournament, all that stuff matters so much.
I want to pause on that idea of multi-tabling, playing more than one tournament at once, because it is something that I think really was not common at all, even when I wrote The Winning Contest Player, gosh, however many years ago that was now. And now I feel like it's become so common, especially among the younger generation of players who are super active, which is, you know, you and some others like you. So how many games would you play at once? And what other lessons do you think you learned from that exercise?
I would be playing back before Engaged Life on a weekend when I just didn't have any care in the, like, not care in the world. It's just different responsibilities and a different life for me now. But when I was just living a single life and just would be like, you know what, I'm only playing horse racing this weekend. If people want to see me, they can come over. I would play 5 or 6 at once, like a variety though. And on horse tourneys and horse players, a lot of times all the featured ones will use the same exact races. So as long as you've done the work, you can kind of fire away and then take strong opinions and weight them. Like I'll play 4 out of 6 entries of this horse, or 6 out of 6, or 2 out of 6, or, you know, and kind of spread it. And as you get down, you kind of like make like a decision tree almost, where it's like, if they're all at the same spot, you can kind of start breaking them apart. If you don't have a strong opinion or you're worried about a race. So I would use kind of like a mathematical approach to just make sure that I had 1 or 2 going, or my best ones. I would hedge with others, play a series of like play a head to head, play a couple like 3-person tournaments, play some 25 person tournaments and then play like two or three of like the featured tournaments that day. And it really, it obviously only works with live on days where they're live, and the days where they're pick and pray, it's a little bit different. You can put in your sets of picks, but you're just hoping for the best after that. I don't like those as much, but, yeah, so I would play five or six, and the lessons you kind of learn were, it's probably too many, to do your best work, because some of the races are so close together, each picks in the moments, or if there's a tote delay, or if there's, you know, an objection or a photo and you get delayed, you don't really, you don't know how many points you have and enough of them to kind of use them as hedging opportunities. So it was probably too many, but I would say, if you're going to play and there are good feature tournaments all going off of the same races, it's worth playing three or four, because if you have a strong opinion in a couple of races and they hit, you've got so many options in the others to at least win one of the tournaments. I mean, because you can spread out your opinion on the races you're not as sure about. So I really preferred it, but it gets expensive if your opinions aren't good.
I'm thinking part of the reason you were able to have such success managing two entries in your first NHC has to go directly back to this experience of multi-tabling and the decision-making and the fast decision-making that you must have learned there. Do you think that's an accurate statement?
Yeah, actually, because two didn't really feel that many when you played six.
Right.
So, and they do a better job there of spreading them out, right? Because the multi or the in an online tournament, they're kind of they're jamming some of them a little too close together, especially if when Gulfstream's involved and you know 0 minutes to post doesn't mean 0 minutes at all. So things like that get a little more difficult on the online ones when they're trying to get it all done within a 2 or 3 hour period. But I mean, the NHC does a decent job of spreading them out. Two is not too bad there. I mean, there's a couple times where it got tight where I would leave myself too many optionals on one ticket left. And like, I think I said to you before that I ended up with too many Golden Gate plays that I really didn't want to make, but it's definitely the experience of playing that many online that made it a lot easier to manage two in a tournament like that.
It is making me think that you will increase your odds maybe more than the average person by being able to pick up that second seat at the last chance. I mean, here's my advice, unsolicited advice, which I always hesitate to give, but I think a lot of people listening might be in a similar position where they want to do the work, but they have this last chance to look at. What about trying to play the early part of the day, almost like a pick and pray, like picking, you know, I think it's a mix of mandatories and optionals, like put some plays in and basically like go to your room and work. And then depending on what's happening in the tournament for the second half of the day, you can either start focusing on it like crazy or focusing on it a little. I mean, I wonder if there's a way you could hedge almost and give yourself an opportunity without taking too much brain power in a wrong direction, well, not a wrong direction, but in a different direction when you have the bigger task at hand.
Yeah, and I like that idea. And I actually thought about that. I thought about playing the whole thing as a pick and pray, or not the whole thing, but almost all of it, and then seeing where you're at. But
yeah, look at the last hour or two.
Yeah, so it's debate. I actually, there are, and if it's all optional or is it?
Yeah, I think it's a blend.
I don't know. Okay.
I think it's a blend. When we get out there, we can see all the rules. Yeah. But it might be something to consider, because I really do think your ability to manage the multiple tickets and to use that sort of leverage could really be something.
Right. It was my second entry that won because it quickly became my first entry because I played two horses in a mandatory race and I think one paid $40-some and my other ticket, I think, had the place horse. So I quickly flipped them and then that just became my main entry. But I mean, it was a huge advantage early, especially when you're playing, just giving yourself two bullets in every race early. If you don't have a strong opinion, just trying to get on the board and figure out which one you're going to run with.
You alluded to how your life has changed, not just because of the NHC score, but because of getting engaged. I'm curious to hear how these changes in your life have changed your horse playing.
I mean, you have a person to think about, and she's just, I mean, we were together all last year and going to the NHC, and she's been extremely supportive of that. Once she kind of, it took her a little while to warm up to it because she was not exposed to gambling in any way or horse racing anyway. And then we started dating, and then all of a sudden she meets me. Well, I mean, we knew each other. We met in law school 10 years ago, and we dated a little bit, but then we kind of got back together, you know, many, many years later, but she didn't really know the extent of what I was involved in. It's kind of when you're not a gambler in any way or anything like that. She watches sports and likes horse racing enough where she'll go, and she's been very supportive, but it took her a while to kind of warm up to this idea that I was going to be playing a lot of horse tournaments, because most people just don't know what they are if you've never been exposed to them, and they just kind of think that it's, oh, you're going to be in these OTB, these smoky OTBs with people screaming at a screen and stuff, and that's not very often that's the case. So just, she's been so supportive, and I try to pick events where she has, it's a place that she really wants to go, or she has like a good friend in, because that just helps giving us both a reason to want to go, and not just me, because it just, I think for her, and I think eventually she'll just maybe not come to all these events, but all the big ones and all the first class treatment I got at so many events this year just because I had won this tournament. I mean, it was pretty easy to get her to want to go when I was, the accommodations that we'd have at all these events. It's changing the amount I play. But I mean, work always did that as well. So like when work's busy, it's just so tough to do the weekly work that you need to do to be ready for the weekend. And you just pick up a form and pick up stats race on Saturday morning and hope that you're ready to go. But it'll change this year a little bit just because we have a wedding to plan and we're hoping to get it in by the end of the year. And there'll be a lot of that and just thinking about another person. I mean, as you know, you gotta pick your battles and pick your weekends. And
yep.
But I mean, she's been amazing. She's been so supportive of it and been my biggest fan. And I mean, she's in all my pictures and everything, and was on stage with me when I won last year with a couple of my friends. And so I couldn't ask for too much more, unless I was like, unless you're dating and someone who actually plays with you every weekend. I mean, other than that, I couldn't ask for a whole lot more, and just how supportive she is. But then there are weekends where I do feel bad and just try not to play very much so that we can, you know, do something else, because we both work full-time jobs and don't always see each other as much as we'd like during the week, even though we live together, but we just have opposite schedules sometimes. So, you know, it's just, it's a balancing thing, and it's going to be different, but, you know, just, hopefully that I continue to play in at least all the big events, and online I can play during the week sometimes on Friday, like Fridays and during work and stuff like that, if there's slow days trading, because I'm in front of screens. So there's ways to do it, but engaged life will definitely, it'll change a little bit, especially this year, because we're going to try to put everything in. So
yeah, that balance you describe is that's what's so critical. And the other key phrase I heard in there for me is choosing the battles and deciding where, you know, really just prioritizing. So there's a way to do it. Even if you're playing less, you can be enjoying it more, and it can be part of a fully formed life. It's difficult for people, and having a partner who understands and you can be honest with about it is and understands that it's like part of who you are, is essential. And it sounds like you've hit the jackpot in that regard.
Yeah, she definitely understands and knows how much it means to me, and she's been very supportive. So I couldn't ask for a whole lot more. And someone who encourages you to do it all the time and does it and everything, I don't know if that's necessarily a great thing either. So
yeah, it's the balancing act. I want to talk I have a very specific Stats Race Lens question, because Stats is a product that makes it so easy to find handicapping angles that are successful. Some players who I've interviewed that were doing double duty today. Not only is this part of our NHC preview material, but I also want you to be included in this book I'm working on with Matt Miller, our friend who you mentioned before, that we're calling Easy Game. And one of the questions Matt had that he wanted to ask that I've busted out for a few players, and a lot of them just sort of like turn left as soon as I say it, asking about favorite handicapping angles. But for you as a Stats Race Lens user, I figure you're more apt to have a favorite angle or two that you might be willing to share.
Yes, I've actually been playing around with that. And I mean, I think we covered some good ones on the seminar that we did, and I'm always trying to come up with different ones. And honestly, the other thing is that angles will change.
That's right.
As if something goes on differently for a 6-month period, you're going to see your angles that light up green and red as high success, low success in your program every day. They're going to change. So, I have ones that when I'll get when I'll get pissed about things that, or someone who's lost me a lot of money. Some of my favorite angles are like that. Like Tyler Bayes in a graded stakes race is one of my favorite red angles of all time. Cause I think if, unless he has a horse that he can just run into the ground and run straight and wins, I think if he has to make a decision at any point, he somehow gets all these short price mounts. But I think if he has to make a decision at any point, he's probably not going to make the right one. And maybe I'm a jerk for saying that, but
you're probably not going to be on his Christmas card list after this, Scott. I'll warn you.
He's lost. Yeah. He's lost me so much money so many times that, so I have like what I call like my vengeful, angle section. And I met last year, he's got a negative 76% ROI and an 8% win percentage. And he gets a lot of short price horses. So I think that's one of my favorite angles is because it'll light up red as like anytime I see graded stakes, Tyler Bayes, just check it out. So I look for him to be on favorites and he still somehow gets to ride those. One of my other favorite angles was that the surprisingly decent ROI that I was telling you last time is that we used on the show is that Chad Brown in maiden, like with first time starters and maiden special weight races on the turf. He's got a surprisingly, I mean, not, no one should be surprised with the win percentage, but he has a, the ROI is actually pretty solid because usually a lot of those races he puts them in are pretty competitive. But, and his win percentage, I think, would even be higher. I looked and a couple of them, he has a lower win percentage because he had two in the race.
Right.
So there's hidden things like that. And then I've been playing around more with the true odds stuff. I think I played around with a little bit when I first started and looked a little bit stats puts out themselves, but the stuff that Matt Vivaldi had mentioned with the true odds stuff was kind of eye opening. So I've been trying to look at more stuff like that. And then a lot of my other favorite angles are looking at every track and kind of putting in different race types and different posts and seeing if there is a bias at any point developing, or if it is really tough in certain races to be way outside on different courses. And I think if you kind of do all that ahead of time, you're not going to get a ton of patterns, but if you get a few of them to light up green or red and kind of open your eyes in a tournament, because you can eliminate, not eliminate, but you can take a longer look at different horses because certain ones are drawn in terrible spots or great spots. And it'll show you those success rates. And just the more that you can think of in stats, the better, because it all lights up for you on game day and it just saves you so much time.
The true odds is worth pausing on because that's a feature within stats that's basically a proprietary algorithm, not unlike the ones we were talking about before, that can help you with the handicapping process and allow you as a horse player a little bit of the man plus machine edge that players using technology possess. Is that the way that you look at it?
Yeah, it'll update. So it'll use the morning line at first when it's kind of showing you the true odds of a horse in their program. And then once the live odds update, yeah, it kind of gives you that real-time look. And if you see, you can put in different angles with true odds relative to the morning line and how much of an edge you want. You can, it'll calculate the morning line into a percentage for you. And then and you can put in, I'm looking for horses with what stats determines they have a 50% edge on the actual odds that they are going off at. And it'll just, you have to trust their algorithm to be right, but you can back test the angles on how often they are right based on what the true odds were in different situations. So it kind of proves itself. So there's just a lot of different ways you can use it, but yes, it gives you real-time data and it'll alert you to relays for you to use in the tournament.
Like we said on the show we did the other day, it's this idea of getting you to be fishing in the right ponds and therefore cutting down an incredible amount of work. And that's something that I just wanted to underline. All right, so the book, each chapter is going to have a story of each subject's most memorable day betting horses. I'm going to go out on a limb and suggest that yours was the NHC last year.
Yeah, definitely. That final table will be something that I'll never forget. I mean, it's harder to run, much hotter. I mean, I had seven races. I think it was three winners, two second place horses, and I think maybe one horse even took third, and then the other horse I think ran off the board or was just terrible. But the amount that I made in the final table with two $30-some winners and three winners overall, I mean, that's for me. I mean, it was just playing the right horse at the right time at the end and just, you know, rallying from, I believe I started in ninth at the final table. So it'll be tough to beat day three, or especially the second part of day three of the NHC for me.
When you reflect back a year on what memories stand out the most from your NHC experience?
Just the energy in the room at the final table was kind of reminded me, you know, the biggest void in my life that needed to be filled was finding something to compete in, and playing baseball all my life and playing all the way through college. You walk off that field the last day and it's like the most empty feeling in the world. And, you know, you kind of search and you play poker and you do all these things. And then once I found these tournaments, I kind of like, well, I kind of start to feel it again. And this is where I need to be. And that was solidified more than I ever thought, like feeling the energy in that room at the final table in the NHC, every race, whether you won or lost it. I mean, there's people just screaming. There's people betting cash on the sides. There's everybody, people, like, I didn't know very many people, but people are just, some people seem like they had half the room rooting for them. I mean, it was just, and by the end, I felt like people were even rooting for me. And I had, you know, I had my friends, some of the younger people, I think they just wanted to see someone younger win. And I had people like messaging me on Twitter afterwards, like saying how cool it was. And I'm a young horse player too, and all those things. And like, it was just, I can't explain it. It was like you were in a vortex and just like, I didn't even know what to do after I won. I just kind of put my hands up and then everyone shook my hand and people were hugging me and whatever. And then I got to bring my friends up on stage and talk to Keith and just look out at everybody and then go on sit with you and Steve Vick afterwards. And I'm like, what is going on right now? Like, this is so crazy. So yeah, that whole last experience was also my most memorable, just because I just can't, if you've never been, I mean, I know that they've had a lot of gate to wire finished at the final table, and this is kind of a little bit more what they were hoping for, is just kind of a seesaw battle. And I think there were four lead changes. Yeah, and I didn't crazy. Lead until I led for 5 minutes of the whole tournament. So maybe I'll add blinkers this year. But
oh, that's great.
It was just incredible energy. I just can't re-race at the final table that went off. The amount of people that were like just so engaged in that race. It was just incredible. And we'll be, you know, I have an even bigger room and this year in Valleys, and everybody will be in there the whole tournament. So I kind of had a different feel for the beginning of the tournament, because I was on the lower floor for the first 2 days. I had a great group of guys at my table, but I mean, I had never been there. I didn't know anybody. I just put my name card on the table, and just whoever I met. And it'll be a little bit different all the way through with everybody in the same room this year. But man, just the environment of the final table, I'll just never forget that.
That's terrific stuff. Do you know who you're sitting with this year? Do you have that all worked out?
Yeah. So I believe it is Matt Miller, Brad Anderson, Matt Vivaldi, Evan Trommer. I've never really talked to Evan. I've talked to his brother Drew, because that's kind of, Drew is a TVG rep. And he's kind of like the Midwest rep that they had assigned to me and talked to me after I'd won, and just to,
it's great. It's
offer me like a trip to Keeneland and stuff like that. So I'm not sure if Drew's coming out as well, but Evan, they named, I feel bad, they named a couple other people in the email, that Matt basically reached out and asked if I had agreed to sit with anybody yet, and I said no. And he had kind of, him and Brad had kind of seemed to be setting this up. So I think I'll have to look again to see who else, but it'll be a lot of fun. I love those guys, and you know, you'll have the BCBC winner and the NHC winner and the third place NHC final tables had Matt Baldy last year. We'll have some things to prove at our table.
It's a sharp table. There's no doubt about it. We're going to wrap with two quick baseball questions. We'll start with one about your playing baseball. What's your defining memory when you think back to your experience playing baseball? Like what's the as far as you ever got?
I mean, the defining, honestly, so I grew up on, we had a pretty small town, but our team was insanely competitive. And I think we won the state championship when we were 10, when we were 12, and then should have when we were 14, but we lost again. So for being a small town, the amount of players that played college was almost everyone on that team. And I think seven guys or something went D1. I ended up going D3 because I just didn't think that I would have played until maybe as a junior in college if I wouldn't have. I had some D2 offers, but I ultimately decided to play at Monmouth, which is a D3 school in Illinois. But winning those state championships and playing at the level I did, my best friend's dad had come out. He had played Major League Baseball for a little bit until he got hurt. But we just ended up with so many incredible players from such a small town. And we just became a family. And I loved that growing up. And then I got to go on to play high school. And then I got a really cool opportunity after I was 18. I got to play on one of these Team USA teams.
Cool.
It was like a junior Team USA where I was the second youngest kid on the team. I think we had I was 18 going to Europe. My roommate was 16. He ended up beating me out for MVP in the tournament, but like I hit like 675 in that tournament or something. It was like, I couldn't have played any better than my room. This little dude from Texas, his roommate, he was 16, hit with a wooden bat. Everyone else was using metal. Hit 750 and for this tournament, and yeah, he beat me out for MVP. But I think we ended up taking the bronze medal. We were in Appledorne, Holland, so that was another one of the coolest memories I ever had. We had college kids on our team, some that were going to college, and then he was still in high school, and it was like a mix of people from all over the U.S. going over there. I don't remember exactly how I got picked, but it was such a cool experience being able to go and play in Europe and then do a camp for kids over there and stuff like that. And then just college, my college coach didn't know how to use a closer at all. So I was the closer, and I think I had broke the all time saves record with like 7. it didn't make any sense, but like, it was a cool moment because people recognized it when I did get it. And I still have the ball from that. I went in as a top outfield recruit and came out as like a closer, and there's a lot of politics there. I don't want to get into that, but it was a cool experience getting to do that and play in college and at least have, you know, a little piece of history there. And so I just think it was such a big part of my life all the way through that I can't explain how empty it was when you knew it was like there was none left. And I knew it wasn't going pro. I mean, it would have taken something incredible to happen to my arm. I mean, I was topping out at like 86, even when I was throwing as hard as I could. And that's just not good enough for you. It was a very cool experience, and I got to play for as long as I did. And I'm just so glad now that I also have this to kind of pick up where I left off there. Cause you leave and you just have so much left competitiveness wise. And like, you're just trying to find something to fill that. It was so tough, and softball did it a little bit, but not nearly enough. Cause you just know you're not competing for like a championship, you know. Right. It's just this, feel and what this gives you is just so incredible for me.
I think this is good. I think I know the answer to this. If you were older, it might be a little bit closer, but I'll ask it anyway.
All right.
Obviously you're a big Cubs person.
If you could bottle
one feeling, are we going to bottle 2019 final table, or are we going to bottle end of the 2016 World Series game 7?
Selfishly, I'm gonna take myself here, but it'll be tough to just because it was, you know, it was you. I mean, doing it and just the experience that I had and just being able to share that with other people, and it was amazing. The Cubs World Series, I can't explain. I'm a nervous drinker. I think with between the rain delay, also extending that, they gave me a receipt, and I had I think it was 21 Captain and diets during the game. And I don't.
That's a JK level amount.
I was in pain for 2 days, but it was crazy. But this, I think I was so happy I couldn't even get drunk. And I think I was so tired. I was up for 24 hours. So I went down to the room I woke up at 6, and I was like, on the final day of the NHC. And I was like, man, if I don't go down there right now, I'm going to regret this forever. So I started handicapping in the room and then went down there early because, like, I mean, I was in 12th going into the day. And I was like, I'll never forgive myself, even though I hate mornings more than anything. But man, I was up for, I think I was out till 5 a.m. after that, but I couldn't even get drunk because I was so happy. But it was just like a different feel.
Did you ever find the ticket? I'm just remembering now that you or some friends who'd bet you to win, and there was a ticket missing, and you had to put in a lost claim. And whatever happened with that?
I bet $10 tickets, and for everyone that came, And I was only 100-1, which is kind of ridiculous, I thought, because I'd never been there before. But I was like, you don't even know who I am. You just had to look back there and figure out, like, you just looked at me at the blank stare, and then you're telling me I'm 100-1. And I got, so I got $50 on, and then they dropped me to 50-1. And I was like, they'd only let me, and so I bet more on that. I lost 4 of the tickets, but none of them luckily were turned in. So they were really cool at Treasure Island, and they, JK told me who to talk to. I talked to the guy that he told me to, and then, they put in a lost claim, and they eventually mailed me the money once it cleared through the system. But
great.
Yeah. So, but I at least got a decent amount of money in on myself and bets. And that is also a really cool moment, cashing a ticket on yourself.
Very satisfying. All right. Last thing, and you can answer it quick because I know you got to go and I got another one lined up here too, but, you mentioned something funny about the Cubs hat. I just assumed it would be the same Cubs hat from last year, but apparently you're coming well armed for this year's NHC.
Yeah, I'm bringing at least 2. So there's a gray one I've been wearing quite frequently lately, but I pretty much, that one I won the NHC has been sitting on the shelf ever since because it was really white at the time, and I didn't want to ruin that. So that will be coming out in either crunch time or if I get down at any point, I'm not doing well at all, or if I'm fortunate enough to make day 3, I'm not sure how I'm going to do it yet, but probably going to start in gray, but that hat's going to, the hat I wanted was going to be with me for sure.
You were a closer. The white hat could be the closer. It could be, who knows? It could be in the playoffs, sometimes you might throw the closer in the third inning, depending on how things are going, modern baseball with these sabermetrics and everything, but you've got the two different opportunities. But if we see, what I'm hearing is if we see you day 1 or day 2, and of course we're rooting for you, we want to see the gray hat, and then maybe the white one will make an appearance eventually.
Yeah, I'm going to have to think a little bit more about it, but I'm starting in gray. One more thing I want to mention, though, is through you, I got a really cool chance to meet, and I think we'll talk about this more at the NHC, but meet Kim Weir. I'm so happy to be able to help them out, and they gave me a pin to wear during the NHC, and I've tried to promote them online a little bit, and we're going to continue, and we'll talk more about it, but I think that introduction was made through you and she started talking to me, but I think it's so important to what they do. And I wanted to make sure I mentioned that.
So,
and we talked about
did.
That more, but
yes.
Yeah. So
there'll be an opportunity. There'll be definitely an opportunity to bring up more about the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation, the great work that they do. I give the link to donate. It'll be at the beginning of this show, trfinc.org/players. And you're just one of the many horse players who wants to give back to these athletes who make the game go round. So you never have to apologize for bringing that up.
Awesome. I just wanted to make sure I mentioned it because it's really awesome what they do.
Excellent. Scott Coles, thank you so much for your time today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That's going to do it for this edition of the show. We want to thank JK, Matt Bernier, and Scott Coles for their contributions to this program. We'll thank our sponsors, including 10 Strike Racing, the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation, and Stats Racelands. Most of all, we want to thank all of you, the listeners, for making these shows so much fun to do. This show's been a production of In the Money Media. In the Money Media's business manager is Drew Cotney. Our chief creative officer is Jonathan Kinchin. I'm Peter Thomas Fornital. May you win all your photos. I can go right. Everybody, just wanted to give a word for our latest partner, Stats Race Lens. This is a product that is definitely worth checking out. You can even get discounts if you use the promo code STATSITM.
We're talking about customizable PPs with comprehensive research abilities, video replays, advanced search and notifications, access to stats true odds, handicapping angles, and back testing. That's what Scott Coles used to help him win the NHC this year, and he's talked about on this show. It's mobile and tablet friendly. Stats Racelens, bringing clarity to handicapping. And make sure you use the promo code STATS ITM, STATSITM.